Welcome to Faith and Family, a radio outreach of Family Life Center International. And now from Greenville, South Carolina, here's your host, Steve Wood.
Hello, this is Steve Wood, and welcome to Faith and Family. Thanks for joining us in this episode. We're starting a mini-series on youth ministry, and I have done some other series on youth ministries. In fact, I've done several through the years. And this one is entitled Youth Ministry in a Post-Pagan World. Now, if you want to know what a post-pagan world is, hang on, we're going to get to it. But we're talking about youth ministry in America during the 2020s and beyond. And one of the reasons I'm hitting this topic again, because, well, first of all, ministering to youth is incredibly important. And given the cultural situation in which we find ourselves, I'm going to suggest some changes to my earlier recommendations, and some of these might even be regarded as major changes. But what we want to do, just like a good physician, we want to diagnose the times, diagnose the culture before we start prescribing. I mean, how would you feel if you went to a walk-in clinic and the nurse says, come here right away and sit down and we'll start your chemo? And, you know, when the doctor finally comes in to see you, he says, well, actually, I'm here for a sprained ankle. Well, you would sue the person who did something like that for you. But what we want to know is first, what kind of times are we living in? And there's a little verse stuck in the Old Testament that's kind of hard to come across. It's from 1 Chronicles chapter 12 and verse 32. And it's talking about the men of Issachar, Jewish men, who had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do. It's always struck me such a wise group of men. Men who had understanding of the times, diagnosed their situation, their times, their culture, and they knew what Israel ought to do. And I would like to take that process and adapt it to recommendations for youth ministry in a post-pagan world. Now, our culture, it's pretty obvious, has gone through massive cultural shifts in the past half century or so. And these shifts, which you think couldn't continue, say, from the year 2000 to today, but yes, they have continued. And they not only have continued, but they have intensified. And from a Christian viewpoint, these aren't wonderful changes. These are serious challenges because what happens in the culture particularly influences young people and adults too. So what we want to do is do a cultural analysis preceding crafting an effective youth ministry. Now, I myself lived through the pagan explosion of the 1960s. And it was something because at that time, the unthinkable became thinkable. In other words, things that people would normally think of, you can't be doing this. Everybody started doing things, immorality, cultural changes, and I have to admit, I was all for it at the time. And it's one of the major reasons I have never lost interest in youth ministry, because my youth ministry interest is motivated by a concern to keep young people from following down the lost path that I was on until rescued by Christ. But we need to know that the church, and I underscore this, is always, always affected and infected by the surrounding culture. And one of the prime examples you can see of this in the Bible, when you open the book of Revelation after the intro chapter, chapter 1, you have the letters to seven churches in Asia Minor, Revelation chapters 2 and 3. And the fascinating thing about studying those seven churches is that if you study the archaeological findings in those areas, so you know the history, you know the sociology, you know the economy, you know the politics, and you know the religious environment, it all affected the church. And but just for instance, just came to mind the Church of Laodicea, which was lukewarm. Well, they had a putrid, lukewarm water supply. They were very wealthy, just like the church says, I have, you know, wealth, I'm in need of nothing. And, you know, Christ is basically rebuking them, saying, you're bankrupt, you don't realize this. So the church is influenced by the culture. And when culture goes down, the church is definitely impacted. Now, I'm going to read to you a passage that just was eyebrow-raising when it was given by a man by the name of Father Joseph Ratzinger. It was a 1958 lecture. It was a rip-roaring lecture, and it was entitled, The New Pagans and the Church. And in fact, this lecture, coupled with something I'm going to give you in a second from C.S. Lewis, is really framing for me the challenge of wanting to be like the men of Issachar to know the times. Well, this is it, and I quote, according to religious statistics, old Europe is still part of the earth that is almost completely Christian. But everyone knows that the statistic is false. This so-called Christian Europe for almost 400 years has become the birthplace of a new paganism, which is growing steadily in the heart of the church and threatens to undermine her from within. The outward shape of the modern church is determined essentially by the fact that in a totally new way, she has become the church of pagans and is constantly becoming even more so. She is no longer, as she once was, a church composed of pagans who have become Christians, but a church of pagans who still call themselves Christians, but actually have become pagans. Paganism resides today in the church herself, and precisely that is the characteristic of the church of our day. A church in whose heart paganism is living. If you want a copy of that entire address, you can Google the Homiletic and Pastoral Review, or just HPR, and the title of the article is The New Pagans in the Church, and I just Googled it earlier today, and it came right up. But this is striking, but this was 1958. Whoa! I mean, I doubt if Father Ratzinger, who obviously became Pope Benedict XVI, could even foresee what would happen in the 1960s. As the calendar changed with the new millennium and year 2000 and on, who would have thought what would happen? Who would have thought would happen here in the United States of America? Now, the U.S., granted, has been more resistant to paganism than Europe, but thanks to the pervasiveness of the media and the social media and the internet and internet porn and public education, what infected Europe has spread through the U.S. And the danger is, you see, when you have paganism, according to Father Ratzinger, spreading through the heart of the church, well, we all have a tendency to do something we shouldn't do. We measure ourselves by each other rather than measuring ourselves with Christ. And we measure ourselves with each other has gone on steroids when you have the social media and all this type of thing. You start to look what others are doing and other liberties that Christians are taking they probably shouldn't be. And all of a sudden you have a new morality, a new paganism that's in the heart of the church. So I would go a step further than Father Ratzinger did in 1958. In other words, he says, we are now, the church has become a church of pagans. I would say the church is now living, particularly with its young people, in a post-pagan culture. In other words, something sub, something less than a pagan culture. And why do I say that? Well, it's because of my dear hero, C.S. Lewis, who could put in a sentence what would take me a book, and this is what he said. and hear this very carefully. Somebody complained to him about, you know, that we need to make our younger generation more Christian-like. And he said, quote, "First, let us make the younger generation good pagans. And afterwards, let us make them Christians." And that was C.S. Lewis' letter to yours from Jack. And why did he say such a thing? You know, you have to think about this for a while. You know, why don't we make the younger generation good pagans, and after that, let's make them Christians? Well, Lewis also wrote a book, a tiny little book, but it was just a bomb. It was entitled The Abolition of Man. He wrote that in 1943. Again, long before the revolution in our public schools and such. But he foresaw the complete collapse of moral absolutes that was being spread through modern educational systems. And in Lewis's mind, he knew clearly, because he loved ancient literature, and you know history and culture when you do that, he knew that the ancient pagans had a clear sense that there was such a thing as right and wrong. Now, the pagans might have been incorrect in far as what their notions were of what was right and what was wrong, but they certainly had clear convictions of right and wrong. That is now gone. And as a result of that, we're in worse shape than the pagans were. We're not dealing just with, let's make the Christians a little bit better, or let's make even the pagans a little bit better. We are now in a post-pagan culture. In other words, we've lost even the incorrect, phony notions of right and wrong that the pagans had. And I brought this survey up several times, and I honestly don't know why somebody hasn't pulled the fire alarm in the Catholic Church, honestly. Because the Knights of Columbus, a few years back, did a survey of Catholic millennials, young adults. 82% of Catholic millennials agreed with the statement that morals are relative, that there is no definite right or wrong for everybody. I can't tell you what an utter moral disaster this is. You want to know why two-thirds of Catholic youth right now in catechism classes and Catholic schools and Catholic youth groups are going to fall away? Two-thirds? It's because of this. This is actually a foundation that Christianity is built on. And Lewis was saying, yeah, we need to make them more Christian, but first, let's make them good pagans, and then maybe we can make them good Christians. But 82% of Catholic millennials have washed out. They do not have a moral foundation. And you can give them all the instruction you want in doctrine, theology, and moral life, and if it's built on a foundation without moral absolutes, it's going to be fruitless. And what's worse, and this is worse, that this survey was done by the widespread American millennials, and so the Catholics could be compared to just the wider population in America. Now, two-thirds of the population of millennials in America don't hold moral absolutes, and that's a tragedy. That's a national tragedy. But 82% of the Catholic millennials are in that situation. Catholic millennials are the worst in the United States for the future. And if you ignore the culture, you know, it's like giving chemo to somebody that comes into a walk-in clinic with a sprained ankle. It is just off the charts wrong, so wrong. And so what we're talking about is the vast majority of Catholic youth and young adults are post-pagans, okay? And I'm going to try to suggest a youth ministry for this situation. Now, you may disagree with it. That's okay. But I urge you to take a real hard look at this, a real hard look at this. And by the way, we're going to be talking about worldview probably right after this series. But what worldview training does for youth, one of the critical things it does is instill that idea that moral absolutes are a vital part of life, of everything we think about, do, and conceive, and how we make moral decisions and such. So we'll do that. But how do we make real good pagans and thereafter make good Christians out of people living in a post-pagan culture? Well, I would dare say, going back to do in the 21st century youth ministry what was done in the first century youth ministry and family ministry and adult ministry, because it was pagan world. That's what Christianity came into. And the last words Jesus gave in the Gospel of Matthew were these. He came, Jesus came, and said to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you, and lo, I am with you to the close of the age." Just a little P.S., but it's a big P.S. You don't need to get discouraged, because if you're by yourself trying to do this in youth ministry in a post-pagan culture with your eyes open, you say, hey, this is impossible. Hey, how about a bunch of fishermen going out and converting the Roman Empire? That's kind of what you call impossible, too. There was no EWTN. There's no Ignatius publishing houses. There were no Catholic schools. There were no church buildings. There were no seminaries. And these guys turned the world upside down and thereby turning it right side up. So if Christ is with you, you can do things you can't expect to do by yourself. But in the Great Commission, which I just read, the main verb, which is in the imperative tense. Imperative means it's a command. The main verb, the essence, the core, if you were outlining this, diagramming it, it's make disciples. That's the essence of the Great Commission, make disciples. So if you want to have two words which would summarize my recommendations for youth ministry in a post-pagan world, it would be make disciples. And we're going to be talking on some ways that we can do this in the upcoming episodes. But I'm going to share one way with you, and it's built from the scriptures. So how do we make disciples? Well, if we want to make disciples in the 21st century, again, I'm flipping back to the first, something that worked rather well, okay? And there's a principle of concentration in discipleship making. Now, if you go through the New Testament, I just put this together today, actually. I've been thinking about it. But in 1 Corinthians 15, we read there is a pretty sizable group of 500 that experienced a post-resurrection appearance of Jesus. I need to back up just for a moment. Even larger than the 500, there were multitudes that followed Jesus. For instance, in John 6, there was 5,000 for the feeding of the 5,000. Hey, free bread, big crowds. So you had a multitude, which means it was so many people, it was in the thousands. And then you have 500, a smaller number, again, we're concentrating, that were post-resurrection appearances, 1 Corinthians 15. And then in the beginning of the book of Acts, chapter 1 and verse 15, Peter stands up and talks to the brethren. In other words, these are the hardcore that made it through all the trauma of Holy Week and everything else. And it says the brethren were numbering about 120. So we went from a multitude to 500 to 120. Then we go to the Gospel of Luke. And in Luke chapter 10, there was a group of apostles that Jesus sent out that numbered 70. And the reason we're 70, if you go way back to the table of nations in early Genesis, right after the flood, there were 70 nations listed. So Luke is very concerned with the Gentiles and Gentile nations. So multitude concentrated down to 500. Concentrated more to 120, then Luke 10, getting down to 70. And then you have things like St. Mark and St. Matthew and Luke, which we all know there were 12 apostles. So again, this is quite a bit of change from a multitude, 500, 120 down to 12. But even more concentrated than the 12, within the 12, there was an inner circle that Jesus spent special time with, and those people were Peter, James, and John. And for instance, the transforming vision of Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration, only Peter, James, and John were up there, and that's Matthew 17. So basically, Jesus was making disciples. He made disciples. That's what he was doing in the Gospels, and is basically, even though there are multitudes following, and Jesus took care of the multitudes. He fed the 5,000. He got in a boat. And if you've ever been fishing, you should know that your voice travels very well over water. So he got in a boat so he could teach the crowds on the shore. He continued the large group, but to make disciples, you need small groups. You need to concentrate your efforts. And you can't make disciples without concentrating. And just this is kind of on the negative side of things, but two-thirds of your large youth groups today are not going to be Catholics in a few years. Statistically, this is what's happening right now. So we have to do something different or in addition. And again, I'm not saying cancel the large groups because Jesus didn't, but he wasn't just enamored with the large numbers because we think, well, we're being effective. We have a lot of numbers, so to speak. But to be effective, we should say we should also need to start counting down into a smaller group. And Jesus spent a huge portion of his time with a small circle of disciples in order to pass on his life and his teaching to them. Now, today, what I just described of making disciples is a nearly impossible task for the typical parish youth worker. And it's not that youth workers aren't energetic and wanting to do the best, but I just came across this week, in fact, this job description of a Catholic youth worker. And I'm going to read it for you verbatim. Okay. I have been in youth ministry and religious education, developing and managing a youth ministry program for middle school and high school teens, along with coordinating and running all of the various ministries of education at the parish, including Vacation Bible School, elementary religious ed, sacramental preparation, confirmation nights, and RCIA. Now, this isn't in jest. I hope this man isn't married. He was a man, because this would be a disaster for your own. This is way, way overboard. It's just like, okay, youth minister, well, he didn't have a whole lot to do. Let's just load him up. This is inhuman, if you ask me. Now, one of the wisest things that happened to me, I was still a Protestant pastor, but I went to a seminar on how to have a really vital new program in your church, and it was great. It was very good. In fact, it was led by George Barna of the Barna Research Group. But before we left, they stopped us cold. And before you go out that door, if you're going to implement this, write down on a piece of paper, before you add, what are you going to subtract? Because this program, if it's done right, takes time, effort, and focus. And if you're going to make disciples in a post-pagan culture, you need time, effort, and focus. It's impossible for this man to make disciples. Impossible. And you're either going to have to eliminate about 85% of his tasks, because even running a large group of young people, in addition with children's ministry, teen ministry, all the ministries of education, Vacation Bible School, sacramental prep, confirmation nights in RCIA, this is crazy. So here's where my 2024 youth ministry recommendations significantly changes. Rather than giving advice, which I have in previous times we've done this instruction on youth ministry, rather than asking an overburdened youth worker to take on the discipleship challenge, why not instead have teams of laity, and these laypersons who are going to take up the young adult and teen discipleship challenge will have no other parish responsibilities. This is it. This is a focus. And we're going to continue with all the other youth and young adult outreaches and meetings and everything else. And these lay teams who are disciple makers, who run small discipleship groups, work in tandem with the parish youth worker, obviously with the approval of the parish priest. And you're not canceling the multitude meetings, so to speak, but what you are doing is adding lay-led discipleship groups for those young people who are willing and interested in making a commitment to a small discipleship group. And we'll talk about what kind of commitments to ask for. Don't be afraid to ask for commitments. Do you realize the U.S. military perpetually is having trouble the last probably two decades getting recruits, except one, the Marines, because they ask more and they get more? And we need to be able to, and willing to ask that of our young people, have lay people without other parish responsibilities concentrate on this, and we can have an effective youth ministry in a post-pagan culture. I'm Steve Wood, your host, and you've been listening to episode 478 of Faith and Family.
Faith and Family is a radio outreach of Family Life Center International. Visit us online at dads.org to learn more about Catholic family life.